Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
When you're a gay kid, other kids sense that you're different. So it's a really pretty terrifying experience. But among adults, they accept me as one of their own.
This is Death, Sex, and Money.
To die. To expire. To pass on.
The show from WNYC about the things we think about a lot.
I'm scared of walking out of this room and never feeling the way I feel when I'm with you.
And need to talk about more.
We got $70, and we got a pair of girls' underpants.
I'm Anna Sale.
So hi, my name is Margaret Cho, and I'm Korean. I am so Korean. I even have
Margaret Cho has built her career around how she feels different.
It's hard when you're a child of immigrants. You know, you spend half your day in America and the rest of your day in a foreign land.
Early on, her Korean immigrant parents were often the punchline.
You get fucked up shit in your lunchbox. All the other kids would get granola bars and Capri Sun. I would get dried fish.
This made Margaret Cho famous. By the time she was 25, she'd won an American Comedy Award for Best Female Stand-Up, and she had a sitcom. She was the star of All American Girl, the first primetime sitcom with a predominantly Asian American cast.
What do you think your mom would say if she could see us now?
Oh, I know what she'd say. No tongue kissing! No tongue kissing!
It was canceled after 19 episodes. Critics panned it for, among other things, butchered Korean language and pseudo-traditions. Margaret says network execs asked her to lose weight, in part because her face looked too wide on camera. In 1999, she returned triumphantly with a show called I'm the One That I Want. She was done trying to fit into neat categories.
I went through this whole thing. I was like, am I gay? Am I straight? And I realized I'm just slutty.
The special was filmed in her hometown of San Francisco.
Where's my parade?
Her sex life has been central to her act ever since. She makes fun of herself, yes, but she also makes fun of how uncomfortable it makes most of us to talk about sex. She's intent on filling those silences, and has been since she was a kid.
I identified as gay very young.
Like how old?
Probably 9 or 10. And this is the time before AIDS, which I think that the world would never recognize now. You know, it was a time where really gay men had a hold on the world that was really magical, and they could do whatever they wanted. And it was really an amazing, amazing thing to witness.
Who'd you first learn about sex from?
Oh, gosh. I have not had the talk from my parents yet. So according to my parents, they actually have not told me where babies come from. I think I learned the majority about sex when I was a very young girl. My father owned a bookstore in San Francisco that catered to the gay community. And it was a bookstore that had all sorts of art books and photography and then quite a large gay literature section. So I actually saw a lot of different kinds of sexuality in front of me. It wasn't dramatic and it wasn't odd. It was a little bit mysterious because it did not include women. So I witnessed it and I thought, wow, you know, I was really kind of understanding the male body, understanding kind of from afar and kind of from around me. And so it sparked a natural curiosity and it sparked a desire to more lean towards the female sex. Like I wanted to learn more about women. And so, you know, I really thought I'm queer or we didn't have those terms then. You know, I'm different than other girls.
You started by saying you've never talked about sex with your parents.
Yes.
To this day.
We still haven't talked about it.
Can you explain, how did that work where your father, an immigrant from Korea, opened a bookstore, ended up catering largely to the gay community in San Francisco in the 70s? Mm-hmm. How does that occur alongside a silence around sex in your home?
Because he was encouraging the gay men to talk to me about sex. He wanted them to explain everything about life. He wanted them to tell me what art was, tell me what music was, everything. Like he sort of thought this is going to be like my finishing school, because all he knew about really was to clean a fish. Like, he really didn't know that much about culture, but he knew that these guys did. Because these guys were very cultured. They were white. They were young. They were beautiful. You know, all came from very diverse backgrounds. But, I mean, it was a thing where my father understood that he only had so much to give me, but he knew other people who could give me more.
Are you close?
Yes. Yes.
How often do you see each other?
We see each other every couple of months. We talk a lot. We had this period where we were talking several times a day because he's trying to make me do a show in Korea in Korean. And so it's very hard to communicate comedy in Korean. So every day we would kind of try to go over Korean. I still never really got it. It's not a really easy thing to do. Because comedy is very hard to do in any language. But if it's not your sort of native tongue, it's doubly hard.
Do you go to Korea often?
No, I haven't been there for a really long time. And that has to do with my own desire to just kind of like live my own life and kind of break away from my family for a bit. And it's a country that baffles me. The culture baffles me. It's a very weird culture because there's so many great things about it. And yet it's so still extremely sexist and racist and kind of in both worlds at once. It's like very new and very old at the same time.
Why do you think it's important to him that you do a show in Korea and Korean?
I think he just wants me to bring what I have here over there. And also in Korea, the gay community is very, they struggle a lot. You know, there's, you know, a lot of like shame around it. You know, and they have gay pride parades, but they're very small. And people still cover their faces. You know, they don't want to be identified as gay, and the homophobia in the culture is just intensely suffocating. And so I think he would like some kind of solution for that. I know he goes over there often too. My mother and he go over there often. So they sort of are in their own ways kind of like a very, very small version of PFLAG, you know, over there, which is really sweet.
It is sweet.
Yeah.
Back in the 1970s, when Margaret was just a kid realizing she was queer, what it meant to be gay in America was dramatically changing around her.
I was around a lot of gays and lesbians who at the time were very politically active. They were big supporters of Harvey Milk. His assassination was an incredibly devastating thing for the community that I grew up in.
Do you remember it?
I remember it. I remember the candlelight vigil. I remember it being this huge thing that I was not allowed to go. I was too young, and it was too sad. Hmm. So my family's like, no, it's too sad. You can't participate in this because it's just, it's too tragic. It's too sad.
It's too sad.
Yeah, it's too sad for you. You can't go. But I remember all of the people that worked for my father that time were there. And, you know, they were just overwhelmed with grief. And so, you know, it was a weird time in San Francisco. So from that point, you know, I got a little bit older. Then I witnessed the community absolutely destroyed by AIDS. Like you would see people, beautiful, healthy young men, then you would see them looking a little bit off, looking a little bit under the weather. Then you would see them walking with a cane. Then you would see them in a wheelchair. And then you would never see them again. You know, when you see that, you go, now we understand sex is a deadly thing. So that was the age of sex education, safe sex, and we were doing a lot of AIDS fundraising. And so that was the point where I became a comedian.
Because otherwise, it was too sad. That's how Margaret's career began, when she was still a teenager. She quit high school, she was hanging around grown-ups, she was an activist and a rebel.
I had a pretty good relationship with my parents off and on. You know, like somebody would fight, but I would just kind of go off and do my own thing. And then I would come back. I left maybe, it was like 15, 16, then came back when I was like 18, left, came back when I was 20. So back and forth, you know, not so much a runaway, but, you know, I just wanted to be an adult.
So financially independent at a really young age.
Yeah,
then also.
Which is great. I was once almost a female wrestler. I did phone sex.
Really?
For quite a time. But this was so long ago. It was phone sex that was recorded. So, and there was definitely a class system, because if the whiter you sounded, the more apt you were to do the recordings than talk to people on the phone. So if you didn't sound white, as I do, you were relegated to another room where you actually had to talk to people who call you. But since I sounded white, I was able to sort of get the good job,
which is just a long monologue of
you would just describe the different things, or who you are, these different fantasies or whatever. And then we got some sort of contract where we did this thing called Hot Girls USA. So it was specifically for foreign businessmen to learn English. So it was very simple sentences, like, you know, noun, verb, where you described the foreign-looking man and how you were blonde and you were tall, you had blue eyes and large breasts. But again, very, very simple sentences so they could understand English and also have a sexual, some kind of encounter. I don't really know.
Yeah, but there's plenty of incentive to call again and practice your English.
Exactly.
At what age were you when you were supporting yourself with comedy?
I think about that. I was pretty much supporting myself at comedy maybe in my very late teens, early 20s, so like maybe 20. Living my, like, this sort of very advanced life for a teenager. I was trying to escape being a child.
Coming up, how Margaret tried to find her place in real life and on stage through wild sexual adventuring.
I was really trying to figure out what I liked and what I wanted in sex. And when I was a little bit older, I was able to go to play parties and see. And I kind of thought, oh, this is interesting to me because this is like very, very adult.
I've been listening to your stories about cheating and being cheated on.
It's like I'm a sideshow to the main event at a circus.
What's a learning experience and what's betrayal?
Trying to put myself in the shoes of the other man that is getting cheated on is what led me to break it off.
Thank you for sharing. We're still collecting stories. Record a voice memo on your smartphone. You can email it to deathsexmoney@wnyc.org or just email me and write out your story. We'll use some of them in a future episode. And we're also including your stories in our weekly newsletter. You've heard me talk about this before. Every Wednesday morning, I send out an update about what we're working on, other audio we're listening to that we recommend, and some emails that we've gotten from you. It's great, but I want more of you reading it. So we're having a contest. Everyone who signs up for our Death, Sex, and Money newsletter before February 18th will be entered to win 3 books from the Death, Sex, Money reading list. You'll get a package in the mail with a thank you note from the whole team. If you're already subscribed, you're already entered to win, so sign up today. The contest ends February 18th. Go to deathsexmoney.org/newsletter. On the next show, siblings Teddy and Cammy Thompson. They're the children of British folk rock icons Linda and Richard Thompson, whose very public breakup in 1982 was chronicled on their album Shoot Out the Lights. We'll talk about what happened when the entire musical family, Teddy, Cammy, Richard, and Linda, reunited on an album called Family. This is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC. I'm Anna Sale. Margaret Cho's comedy is marked by a certain fearlessness. Part of the act is how she's constantly subverting expectations about Asian American women. Demure, she is not.
It was an S&M themed sex club. I don't know if I'm a bottom because it turns me on, or if I'm a bottom because I'm lazy.
S&M, sex parties with multiple partners, Margaret's done all of it and has talked about it, including on her current television show, All About Sex on TLC, where she gives advice about things like wearing socks and orgasms.
Stimulated the nerves in your ankles, so I think there's something to ankles and orgasming.
She's proudly outrageous. Part of that impulse, she says, comes from being abused when she was a kid. She doesn't like to talk about the details, though, to protect other young people who are hurt along with her.
My childhood was really very odd. You know, I had a lot of sexual molestation, and I had a lot of, very inappropriate things happen as a teenager, too, that really wrested control from me. And so I was eager to become an adult and become involved in this alternative sexuality to gain some control
and power
over my life, which is what I did, where it could be kind of fantastical. And it brought the fun back into sexuality. It wasn't threatening anymore. And then in there, there's quite a danger as well, you know, because once you do that and you kind of claim your sexual adventure some side, you can really actually be victimized again. And that's a really terrible thing. You have to be careful because you still got to protect yourself within these sort of so-called liberated communities because it's a very, very, it's a difficult world. I think women's sexuality, we often considered public space. And it's very hard to get people to understand, like, even though we claim we want this thing and we want sexual freedom, that doesn't give anybody the right to come and take it. You know, it's just a very complicated thing. It's very hard.
Are you just like the murkiness of consent, even when you're in a sort of liberated environment?
Yeah, exactly. Because consent becomes very, very diluted, you know, in environments where we're encouraged to be sexual and we're encouraged to be open. And that is, you know, we're talking about play parties. We're talking about BDSM. We're talking about these communities that are really actually thrive in their negotiation. The most successful kinds of relationships in these communities really are built on intense negotiation. And so when there's not a great, great level and a commitment to that, it can go very wrong.
Negotiating boundaries and trust, that was also part of her marriage. Margaret married artist Al Ridenour in 2003, and throughout their marriage, they acknowledged that they had other partners but were committed to each other. Until last year, when they announced their divorce. Is there part of you that feels, I mean, your marriage was an open marriage and you talked so much about how you managed that as a couple. Mm-hmm. Has there been any sort of feeling of pressure that you had presented this alternative arrangement and as a way that could work and now the relationship is ending?
Yeah, but the reason for our split has nothing to do with that part of our relationship. It really is actually completely outside of that. You know, there's other issues that it's unfortunate, but people just also grow apart, and that's just the truth of relationship. Sometimes you're only meant to be with somebody for a certain period, and you know, it's like the point of fall and winter. You know, we need to get rid of things so that we can regenerate into the spring. So it's just a cyclical thing. And if you can accept it as that, then because that is the real truth of it all.
Margaret's 46 years old, and she's been surprised that in relationships now, she's craving something simpler.
I would say I'm retired now because it's actually not as appealing to me.
You're retired.
Well, retired from swinging, sex parties, orgies, huge kind of group sex situations. And the weirdest thing was like I realized now, oh, I just want somebody to hold my hand. Mm-hmm. You know, like I want to share a milkshake with somebody. And the horror in me, like this great sexual adventure, realizing that all I want is these really simple things that I never really had as a kid. It's kind of fun. It's really funny.
When did that come to you?
Pretty recently. I realized I never had that sort of time where everything was very innocent. I never had that sort of time where you took things really slowly. And I realized, oh, I need that now, you know, because I have to go back and do that part. It's kind of like going to get your GED. You know, like I actually like did all this stuff. Like I did all this advanced stuff, got a master's, whatever, doctorate, but I never got past third grade or whatever, you know, yeah. So I have to go do that preparation work.
Yeah. And it's interesting. I've never thought about, like, when it's slower, it can be so much more, there can be so much more vulnerability involved because you're not sure if you initiate this one step, if that mm-hmm. person is ready for that. It's not,
yes.
you know, it's not an agreed upon, like, sex party. So you
right.
have to sort of nudge your way.
And it's very scary. You know, it's really scary to just be a person with another person. You know, that is the truest kind of intimacy that I'm learning about, which is really like touching and holding somebody's hand and really finding out what is sexuality, what is exciting, what is true intimacy, what is a true turn on, as opposed to what is flashy and dynamic and seems like it's cool and whatever, a lot of props and costumes, but really, you know, maybe that's not the solution. But I can tell people who are looking for that how to get it.
That's comedian Margaret Cho. She's on the road this winter and spring with stops in California, Tennessee, Pennsylvania, Canada, and elsewhere. Details are at margaretcho.com. Death, Sex, and Money is a production of WNYC. The team includes Katie Bishop, Emily Botine, James Ramsey, Chris Bannon, Greg Rippon, Caitlin Pierce, and Zachary Mack. The Reverend John Delore and Steve Lewis wrote our theme music. I'm on Twitter at Anna Sale, and so is the show at Death Sex Money. And don't forget, sign up for our newsletter. Go to deathsexmoney.org/newsletter. So Margaret Cho's career has been one reinvention after another. But she says, compared to her extended family in Korea, one thing has stayed the same.
All of my relatives have had some sort of plastic surgery, which, like, I think I'm the only person in my family, besides my parents, that look like we're from that family. So it's really weird. We're like the only ones that look like us still. So I'm not sure, you know, what that's about.
I'm Anna Sale, and this is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC.